everyone, and welcome to another episode of Horror Homeroom Conversations. I'm Elizabeth Irwin.
I'm Gwen Hoffman.
I'm Dawn Keeley.
And in today's episode, Vincent Price helms House of Usher, a dark tale of decay inspired by Edgar Allan Poe's 1839 short story, The Fall of the House of Usher. Released in 1960 as the first in the Corman Poe cycle of films, the movie follows Philip as he visits the Usher mansion in the hopes of convincing his runaway fiancée Madeline to return to him. But his efforts are continually thwarted by Madeline's brother Roderick, who warns Philip that marriage to Madeline will result in total personal destruction. Merging elements of the gothic sensibility that marked Poe's career with a specific brand of 1960s film affect, House of Usher is a surprisingly overlooked film in the gothic horror canon. But should it be? We're breaking it all down today with spoilers, so stay tuned. So what'd y'all think?
I was waiting for it. I enjoyed it.
Like, that's it?
Yeah, because I guess I didn't have any expectations. Yeah, I thought it was a good film.
Well, that's good.
We can end there, right?
Right?
Yeah, I thought it was great. I mean, I love Edgar Allan Poe. I love The Fall of the House of Usher in particular. I thought this was a really good adaptation that really kind of captured what Poe was doing in the story. I mean, there are a couple of differences from the story, including the fiance arriving, but I thought that worked. So yeah, I thought it was good.
I think I was less enthusiastic than the two of you, which is yeah. kind of hysterical,
right?
Given that this is the time period of the films that I enjoy the most. But I thought it was okay in the beginning. Like, the first half for me really dragged, and I thought there was a lot of unintentional humor. Like, I found myself laughing hysterically at some of the acting choices. Having said that, the second half of the film, I think, really picks up and sort of dives into the dread that I think I was looking for the film. It is cool the way I think this adaptation plays with the way Poe utilized totality in his own writing. It definitely gets incorporated in the film. And I liked sort of the structural sentience, too, that was happening. But
structural sentience?
Yes.
So that's why I break that down for our listeners.
The house is its own character.
Yeah.
And I
like that.
Yeah, I did enjoy that part. And there's like something, like, and we'll get to that, but what happens to Madeline at the end of the film truly is horrifying when you think about it.
Oh, yeah.
So the first half of the film, if you can stick it out, just try to look for the humor. The second of the half of the film, I think, makes it worthwhile.
So where do we think it deviates the most from the story? Because I did admit I didn't read the story. So from those of you in the room that have, where does it deviate?
I would say the most important things are the visitor, Philip Winthrop, in the film, who comes is trying to get his fiancée, Madeline, who he had met in Boston. Mm-hmm. So she clearly got away from the house, lived a slightly normal life for a little bit, then went back to the House of Usher, and he's coming to retrieve her. In the story, it's an old friend of Roderick Usher's who rides up, and we're not given any sense that either Madeline or Roderick have left the house in quite a while.
See,
yeah, that's the main point of difference.
And I'm glad that you answered that, because that was a huge plot hole for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because in my head, I was thinking to myself, well, if she got away and was fine all that time, long enough to meet a man, live in another city, get engaged, then isn't it possible? So the only thing that I could say that was good about that is then maybe it drove home the sheer madness behind the idea that ushers are doomed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, in the story, too, Madeline's sort of depicted as like the representation of the madness. So you get a lot of sort of her decay happening. And they talk about it in the film, but they don't, like, both Roderick and Madeline never look like they're decaying. They just say they are.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was a big sort of difference in the short story that I was kind of looking for.
And I actually, when Liz texted me saying she was finding it amusing, and I said I did sort of let out kind of a bark of laughter at one of the creaking doors. But the main issue I had in the first half of the film was, yes, that Madeline and Roderick were supposed to be dying. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Madeline looks like the picture of health.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Well coiffed and yeah. full face.
Fabulous. It's
like, we can't really believe that. But that is the thing that's driving the story. Roderick and Madeline Usher are the last of their line. And Roderick, and I think Madeline too, in the end, they're convinced that they're doomed, that they're about to die. And actually that they should die because the entire bloodline is pure evil, which gets to another serious contradiction here. Roderick and Madeline don't seem to be evil.
No.
And
no.
yet the whole point of the story is we're so evil, we must die.
So are they supposed to be twins?
In a lot of adaptations, they are. I don't think in the short story that... Yeah, they are they?
I don't
remember
think
that.
They're twins.
Because I kept reading in places that they were supposed to be twins.
Other film adaptations have definitely cast them as twins, but I didn't remember it in the short story. I could be wrong.
Poe tends to like twins, but I'm not sure that they are.
But the point you bring up about the house was really interesting to me because I made sort of a list of other horror films that I could think of where the house sort of becomes its own character and like what the history is. So with something like Amityville Horror, there's a murder that happens. So there's like this actual legitimate trauma that you know is associated with the house. We don't get that in this. Like, we don't know what the trauma really is. We don't get enough details to really understand if this is a curse that is being revisited on the generations because of an agreement made with a previous ancestor, or if this is just an evil supernatural entity.
Yeah, because the way that they talked about it in the film, it just made it sound as if our predecessors in our bloodline are just such horrible people that
right.
we're just kind of doomed to repeat this until we all die off.
But it didn't make any sense
no.
because you don't see any of that. You don't get any inkling of, well, what did they do that made them this horrible person?
And I mean, they gave a list of like burglar, thief, smuggler, flesh peddler. If it's the family that's cursed, then why does the house play such a role? So that's, I have a little cognitive dissonance with that.
And would you have need the house to literally be brought to another country
and
if
then
it's
why
the family?
And why can't we leave the house?
Right.
Lots of questions.
Unanswered questions.
One question that has been and should be answered correctly is that Madeline and Roderick are twins in the story.
Oh.
In this film, they look nothing alike.
And they don't mention anything.
Yeah. And Roderick looks significantly older than Madeline. But, mm-hmm. I mean, my understanding was that the evil here, like in most haunted house stories, including the ones you mentioned, that it was generated by the people that lived in the house. I mean, I think Roderick says something like, evil is not just a word, it is a reality. Like everything alive, it can be and was created by these people. So I think like it's sort of like an accumulation of evil over the generations, and it seeped into the house.
Oh, that would make sense.
Evil is rooted in
okay.
its stones, Roderick said, which kind of makes you wonder why they bothered bringing it from England to New England if they know it's evil.
I struggle then with the whole idea of the tarn or the loch or the lake or
the
whatever
tarn,
you want to
yeah.
call it. Because that seemed to feature pretty prominently in it. It kind of opened up, it swallowed it, and it seemed to be part of this nastiness. So maybe it's just that the house kind of brought something that then killed the land and then infested the tarn.
Mm. Well, though, it's almost like the tarn is getting revenge. I mean, I loved the speech where Roderick talks about how, I guess, the evil of the family didn't just seep into the stones of the house, but into the land around it. And it's gone from being fertile to being barren. It says something like, and the land withered as before a plague of evil. I almost feel like the tarn is almost like good or natural, and it's swallowing the house to kind of expel the evil from the land.
And then if you look at it that way from with that language, then you can maybe parallel that their bloodline is a plague.
Mm-hmm. A plague that spreads even into inanimate things like the house. I mean, that is pretty much every haunted house movie, right? Like, the house itself isn't inherently evil. It's cursed with something that humans did within it.
Because
I think it would be interesting to have, like, a self-sufficiently malevolent house.
Yeah, because if you think about it, like that description kind of makes it seem almost like a precursor to something like burnt offerings.
Yeah.
It seems like that's doing something similar. The only thing I could think of is maybe, and yeah, it's not a house, but the Overlook Hotel. That is something that's completely separate and that it just sort of got revisited
Infected the people who lived within it.
Yeah. Mm. But that's the only one I can think of where...
There's The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson, which begins with a famous paragraph about the house itself.
Like, and that precedes
that
the
precedes
infection.
The characters coming into the story.
So I think my other broader question, since we have the experts in the room, is what makes this gothic and what tropes are important from here? I mean, it is a pretty overtly environmental, like the whole, the dark, the dreary, the setting, the scene, the castle kind of on the hill, even though it's not a castle per se.
It kind of looks like a castle. It really does. A lot of people define gothic as just sort of all the tropes of the gothic, like, you know, the ruined castle, the evil male patriarchal villain figure. The persecuted female, the creaking doors, the cellar, the crypt. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like this film has them all.
Yeah, absolutely.
It really does.
Yeah, and it also has like the two close siblings, which I think features into
a
lot of
thing.
Stories. There's also the artwork, because we were talking before podcast about how honestly spectacular the artwork is in this film. And I feel like in gothic stories that usually features that you have some sort of painting or some sort of capturing of ancestors or previous generations that get revisited. And I thought that this film did it in a really interesting way.
Yeah. Portraits. They're really huge in gothic literature and film. And then the sins of the fathers being visited on the children. And I think Philip actually says something like that. You know, our ordinary hero says, I don't believe in the sins of the father being visited on the children. He's anti-gothic. Like he tries to be sort of the voice of reason. So he's like, oh, that what the fathers do does not cast sin on the children, but in gothic it always does.
In a lot of gothic stories, the afflictions are specifically tied to the female characters, and it was kind of neat to see Roderick is afflicted with many things and to sort of get that reinterpretation. I thought it was pretty neat, especially for a 1960s movie.
What did you make about all of his sensitivities? Like, what was
so weird.
The point of that in the film exactly? Like, what function did that have? I mean, he was very sensitive to light, to sound. You know, the film starts almost the second scene. The hero has to take his boots off because they're making too much noise.
Maybe his sensitivity, quote unquote, makes him dying. Weak? I don't know.
Well, I think it's supposed to indicate like his decay, but
decay
honestly, Vincent Price's acting of these afflictions has to be experienced. I thought it was funny. You guys seem to have found it way more serious than I did. I was howling because he's so dramatic about it.
He is.
But you don't ever buy that he's afflicted with anything because he looks like he's the picture of health as well.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Just all that makeup.
Yeah.
He's a large, strapping man whose hair is also well done. His eyes are piercing. I mean, I definitely wouldn't look at him and think, wow, we better call the AARP. Like,
he's wasting away. He'll be in the crypt in a second. Yeah, no, I thought that too. That was not good casting on either of their parts. I mean, they should have made... Unless it was a purposeful choice, because, you know, I keep getting stuck on this, right? The Ushers are evil. Mm-hmm. Madeline clearly does not seem evil. Mm-mm, and Roderick, he seems a little weird at first, and he does seem to be trying to kill his sister. You know, it's a self-sacrifice for the greater good. You know, he's like, we got to die because we're evil. So I'm going to make sure I kill my sister and she never reproduces and the Usher line ends. I mean, he's kind of like a romantic hero almost, you know, self-sacrificing. That's not evil. And then they're both supposed to be dying, but they look perfectly healthy. So, I mean, I wonder if the film is making a point that maybe this is like all in their head. They think they're, a kind of madness. They think they're doomed by their family. But maybe they just need to snap out of it.
Or maybe they
go to Boston.
Because then maybe they're actually creating it.
Yeah, they're creating it.
Because if they're well enough, certainly the thoughts and actions of Vincent Price were enough to make her believe she was afflicted.
Yeah. And yet they are just creating the problem. I mean, that's a great way to put it. Like, to the extent that Madeline might be dying, it's because she doesn't eat.
Yeah.
For instance.
Right.
And because her brother puts her into a coffin. So, yeah, they're creating the problem they think they're suffering from.
Definitely felt like the house was more evil than the siblings. Because it seemed to be actively trying to kill the fiance.
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah. The house seems more malevolent. Like the weird, the chandelier falls. The coals jump
out of Adam. Yeah. Like it just, and every time he would talk about taking her out, another crack in the foundation would happen. So I don't know. I felt definitely the house was more malevolent.
Maybe it's the house all along.
We're going to have chicken and egg conversations this whole time, I think.
Yeah, I like that. It's the house all along, and it's just sucked certain family members into a belief in their own evil, and then they enact that evil. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And I mean, I know, so my wife is obsessed with paranormal, like, shows. And in a lot of cases, like, in real life, people will say that they're drawn to a house and they can't explain it. So maybe that's part of the affliction, too, is somehow they're just drawn to this house and they can't divorce themselves from it, which then in turn makes them more mad. And then they kind of afflict it on one another like that plague.
The lineage part is really interesting to me because there's also the presence of a servant, for lack of a better word, in the house who is a participant in this. And so if it is this sort of like shared hallucinatory experience, how does he factor in terms of like perpetuating the evil of like, you know, the lineage argument?
He just does what he's told. I mean, you kind of get the sense that he would be kind of down with Madeline leaving.
However, I'm glad you asked that because I feel he stated in the film that no matter what, he's going to die with the house.
Right.
So his allegiance seemed to be to the house to the point that he was willing to try to perpetuate Roderick's lies. Like he was continuing on with it, whether he was wholeheartedly believing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And maybe that it does speak to the performance of this madness that he wasn't born as an usher, but he buys into it because he's in this house and he believes kind of in the house's power.
Mm. And he also was with previous generations as well.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He's sort of seen it replicated. And I guess after a while, you would start to believe it.
Yeah. So what do we think about Philip as a hero? Is he an effective hero? I mean, he has plump lips. Boy, does he have plump lips. I kept staring at them. I was like, boy, you are. And did you love?
I can't.
The glistening glycerol tears coming down his eyes.
Oh, I live for that. That was one of my favorites. Yes.
He has
some amazing reaction shots.
Pretty.
Like, give it up for him. He's not a very good actor. Like, I think that was the problem. Like, for me, this film is not particularly well acted. For as much as I love Vincent Price, the acting is horrendous. But Philip, in particular, it's such a weird casting because we were, again, talking before we started recording about, well, why is he even here? Because, like, in the short story, it's an unnamed narrator. He has a relationship with Roderick, which I personally think is a much more interesting dynamic than sort of invoking this romance that nobody asked for. The problem with Philip for me was that you don't have any sort of understanding about his and Madeline's relationship, that if that's supposed to be the driving force and we're looking at him to sort of save her, we don't get enough of a backstory. We don't get enough of their interactions to even root for them. So there's no sort of emotional buy-in. Like there would be in the short story where they have this shared history since childhood.
So maybe it posits that as the film, they're trying to drive home the idea that it isn't real, this plague. Because if you have him who knew his fiance outside
the house,
he serves to be like, come on, guys, this is lunacy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you obviously can leave the house. The house didn't crumble.
Yeah.
You didn't die. You were in perfect health. You still look like you're in perfect health, except I just don't want you scrawny.
And just don't want you scrawny.
So eat your gruel, woman.
The gruel.
But it's almost to counterbalance Vincent Price, who's wholeheartedly believes with every breath that he is dying and going to go mad and have the strength of monsters.
But then that also supports the idea of it being the house that's the evil entity, because at a certain point, Philip starts to believe it. He sees the decay of the house occurring, yeah, and he starts to believe that there is a certain madness taking place in the house. Now, whether he buys in to the same sort of mythology as Roderick and Madeline, not really, but he does think there is something not right in the house. But I think, again, what we were talking about before, I think the whole reason that we have Philip is because so many adaptations have kind of hinted at an incestuous relationship, mm-hmm, between Madeline and Roderick. And I think that was just sort of a defense against that reading, especially in the 60s.
Good call. Yeah.
So I don't know that maybe it does have a narrative function. I mean, I think it might have just been a way to sell the film.
I think he's the ordinary kind of normal point of identification that we often need in horror films. Post-fiction doesn't have that. You're usually just plunged into the weird and the strange. He brings that kind of normality. I mean, you know, I thought his character, that was where I most wanted to laugh. You know, when he looks at the fissure in the house and he's just like, you're going to repair that thing? And, you know, he just tells Madeline to eat. And he's like, all we have to do is leave the house. I mean, he voices all of those like common sense things that actually I was feeling as a rationalist. So he is a point of identification.
Yeah.
And maybe he's also there, too, then, for as the film goes along, to show like that kind of rational perspective, like just, you know, fix the crack, doesn't work in this house with this family. Like they're too far gone. We're too far in the kind of gothic descent into madness here for anyone to escape.
It's a good point, because yeah, my question I was thinking of just prior was, who's the audience supposed to identify with? And I guess it is supposed to be Philip. If you think about it.
Yeah, just repair the crack. He's, I mean, weren't you thinking that?
He's the representation of normalcy, per se.
Yeah.
Looking back now, it's comical. But gothic or horror, what makes this film unnerving? If we don't have incest, if we don't, mm-hmm, is it supposed to be just the setting?
I think it's what happens to Madeline. Like, to me, that was the most horrifying part. Like, she has something where
catalepsy.
I'm so glad you said that, because there was no way I was saying that word. So that's good. But she appears dead, and Philip doesn't realize she has this, but the other two men do, and they put her in a crypt, and you can literally hear her scream and like she's trying to claw her way out. And she's in there for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's horrific. And that to me is scary.
And then she is kind of monstrous when she gets out. Like the camera focuses on her eyes. She looks kind of zombie-like or vampire-like
pale-faced
or something.
Yeah. She's clearly gone mad. But you would go mad if that happened to you. So I don't know that that was the curse. Because Roderick's like, see, I told you. I'm like,
yeah.
And she seemed to have red paint on her hands.
Well, there was that too.
Yeah.
Her hands are bleeding from clawing her way out, Gwen.
Her way out of the tomb.
That was the one thing I giggled at, is the frequent drips of blood, like as the trail, and then the man-sized hands on the wall.
Yeah, it didn't match.
I was like, does not match.
I mean, that is more of that self-perpetuating thing. Like, you know, her brother, you know, puts her in a coffin alive. And so, yeah, she's kind of mad in all senses of the word when she gets out of the coffin. So, you know, she hurls herself at her brother and they both go up in flames.
So do we truly believe that Roderick is doing it from a place of altruism, or do we think it's ownership or not being lonely?
Point.
Because especially when you have the candles, and they make a point about the candles, like down to two candles.
Yeah.
And they're red.
Right.
So again, I was telling you, I read something about it signifying passion. So without his, for lack of a better term, twin flame.
Oh, wow. True, though.
Does that then nod back at least feelings for her that are slightly unnatural? And I think about like different types of magics that are out there. And a red candle is often associated with love. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it just struck me.
I do think the incest is more muted than in the story. Mm-hmm. But there are hints of it in the film. I mean, Roderick does not like the fiance. It is a kind of classic triangle with the two men literally battling over the one woman.
Yeah.
The men are in her bedroom at different times.
That's you know, true, yes.
Roderick goes to her yeah. bedroom and stops Philip from going to her bedroom to, you know, rest her away.
That's a good point.
So, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, and it is like on one level, it's a story of a brother who buries his sister alive rather than let her leave with another man.
Yeah.
I mean, put it reductively. And it is interesting, too, that Roderick is the one that talks about reproduction. He said, I love this line. It's got to be significant. She can't wed and bear children. It would spread evil like a malignant cancer. I mean, you know, that seems like he's kind of jealous and wants to keep her to himself and stop her from having sex.
Mm-hmm.
So on one level, he just doesn't want the Usher line to be perpetuated. But on the other hand, he doesn't. He wants to keep her to himself. You talked about the basement mm-hmm. as a kind of womb, Gwen, and which is kind of odd at first glance because down in the basement or the crypt, there's just a whole array of caskets for everyone in the family. Well, so it's more like a big old tomb than a womb, but maybe they're the same thing. Freud would probably have something to say.
I know. I was going to say, if we go yeah. Freud, a lot of times what, you know, subconscious mm-hmm. and whatnot. But I thought about it. If the house is the origin of the evil, it's almost yeah. like a mother and it kind of birthed Ooh. All of them. And then it's almost like a returning to the mother because it's going to stay there. I don't know. It just seems like this internal part of a female house that holds all the genes, you know,
mm-hmm.
in some kind of a way. So, yeah, I understand that they're returning back and they're dead. But they also talked about how death doesn't cure it. So it's just like this, I don't know, gathering place within the mother of the house.
It's almost like it's like down there is a place of death that's also birth, as in giving birth to evil. And it's a place of birth that just breeds death. So it's like, yeah, death and birth are kind of interwoven down there.
And then if you think about imagery, now, again, this is a stretch, but, you know, you have water, so feminine energy. You have fissures, which
yes.
can be feminine yeah. energy.
Yeah.
Saying the feminine's evil. I don't know.
I think it is. I do think it is. Yeah. I mean, Roderick is particularly concerned to stop Madeline, the woman.
Yeah.
Like, she's the one that could spread evil, like malignant cancer.
And
like
the house,
which is feminized.
When your stereotypical male hero comes in and threatens to take the female out. I mean, still a lot to wrap my head around.
But the feminine definitely is the monstrous here. I mean, just because of how Madeline, you know, pops up at the end as this sort of, well, literally a monstrous feminine that is associated with water and death and birth and all of that.
Speaking of the monstrous feminine, did you think anything of her screams? Because I know that you do a lot with the screams in horror.
I have no thoughts on
no
this.
No thoughts on that.
No,
I touched on a sensitive topic.
Very sensitive. No,
I'm going to get in trouble after this.
No, it was a really good scream.
You can just replicate the screams and have done with it. No analysis needed.
No, I'm just going to insert them right now.
Oh, that would be great.
But it is such a great example of like a lack of agency, because it's interesting because honestly in horror films, screams a lot of the time do return the agency to the woman. And here it's the complete inverse. I mean, it's a recognition that she has no agency and that she's trapped. So that was pretty interesting.
But then she bursts out of the tomb. I don't know,
but is
if
she
she's
still
screaming at that point? I think isn't she just screaming
she's
when she's
silent?
Trapped?
Yeah, yeah, she's silent when she breaks through.
Okay,
and I don't think she says anything either.
Yeah,
I think
I don't
it's
think
just
she does.
Strictly like the creature from Frankenstein.
Yeah.
It's just sort of this
You're right.
hobbling after people who've done you wrong.
Yeah,
what do we think about the ending? Do we think that it leaves us with a resolution? Does it leave things open-ended? Do we think that the bloodline is done?
Yeah, it seems like a happy ending. I mean, it's like the ending of Frankenstein when the creature is killed by the fire and, you know, doesn't that structure catches on fire and he falls to his death? That's
yeah.
either, I think that's Frankenstein. Or the Bride of Frankenstein or both. But so it is like that. I mean, the evil And it would have had to have been because of the code. The evil is destroyed by fire and Philip gets to leave.
Yeah, you have that return to the patriarchal order. Yeah.
And do we get the sense that Philip's afflicted afterwards?
I don't think so.
I don't either.
I don't think like there was any sort of madness transferred to him via the experience, which also supports the idea that it was just the house because it wasn't enough for the experiences within the house because he seems relatively unscathed. I mean, he's just happy kind of to have survived.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't seem too broke up about losing it.
He's not the kind of... just go back to Boston. It's fine. There's lots of women.
He's not the kind of person who would be affected by any of this.
I think he's probably more upset that he had to leave his good shoes in the house and he's still wearing those silent slippers. No good.
Had to swap his boots for slippers.
That's right.
Did you either of you watch the Netflix series?
I did.
I loved it.
So good. Did you? You watched all of it?
Oh, I had watched it before we ever even thought of this film, like doing this film.
Oh, my goodness.
It is so good.
Okay, so question. Did you have a hard time getting into it? Because I've heard a lot of people say, like, the first episode is a bit of a chore, and it's only in the – right?
Really?
Because we were doing this, I started watching it, and I was having trouble getting through the first episode.
You have to do the second episode, and that will determine whether you like it or not.
It drew me in because I was so curious why we were sitting here confessing our sins.
Right.
So that the Roderick Usher at the beginning who's confessing to Dupin.
Yeah.
So
– Dupin.
I was actually bothered by that. I mean, they just threw in all these Poe names.
Yeah,
they did.
Completely random, like from every assortment of stories. And that sort of bothered me. It seemed shallow. But I know I should stick with it.
Oh, I agree. I mean, it's definitely, it's used as a scaffold, I think, for the story. But there's definitely a lot of liberties taken.
Oh, it's a mix.
At the end, I mean, it kind of goes back to the House of Usher. With he tries to kill his sister again.
Right.
And then kind of reemerges similar to the end of this film.
They return back to the house because I think one of the knocks against the Netflix series is that you really do get taken out of that house environment and it becomes more about sort of like the legacy for the family.
And the terrible things that they do with the pharmaceuticals.
Right. But not all the family members. There is at least one family member who is
that married in?
No, I'm thinking of the granddaughter.
Oh, yeah. So it gets the sense that it can be kind of bred out.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, they still have to, even if they've done nothing, they're still in that lineage that has to be destroyed.
Does the pharmaceutical company make sense? Because I've heard about that, and I'm like, where's that coming from in Poe?
I think it does because of how he came into it and also the damage they're doing to a really large amount of people.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also the origin story, right? Like
absolutely.
That's what facilitates them making the deal that then gets revisited on the other generations.
Okay.
But how they incorporate different elements of the stories, I think you'll like. But the second episode, the ending was really shocking to me.
Okay. Yeah.
I guess I'll stick with it at least till then.
Yeah,
it does give that a try.
It does give you the sense, though, since it was brought forth by a deal and by the rape of his mother.
Right.
So, like, a horrible act, then sealed by a deal, that it's the bloodline that's cursed. So that, in turn, is why it can't. So if it's genetic... that it can be bred out, kind of.
Well, but remember, they made the deal specifically, which is why Madeline never wanted to have children, because she's like, what's the point?
Yeah, but some people, I get it. So some of it's still in their head, though.
I don't think so. I think because the angel of death or the demon or the devil, however you want to see her, I think it was because it was a specific deal made. But my question would be, since you've seen both, do you prefer this adaptation, the film, or did you prefer something a little bit more long and winding, like the series?
I liked the long and winding.
I did too.
I really did too.
Okay.
Boy, but they also had so much more time to develop characters.
Mm-hmm. Oh, of course.
And to really just loop you into the drama. And the type of drama today is very different than the type of drama, you know, in 1960. So...
Well, I guess like the film, it stays fairly close to the source material.
Yeah,
whereas the Netflix adaptation really just looks at Poe's work and kind of picks and chews and, you know, puts it all together.
Pulls bits
in a blender and is like, here you go.
Here's a black cat.
Yeah.
Here's the sound of a heart. We're going to put them all in there at once.
Which is, were there ravens?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yes, of course.
If you even look, if you look at the title of each episode, one is, I think, the Telltale Heart.
Yeah.
One is the Raven. One is Murders of the Rue Morgue.
Oh, like, cool.
So that's
I do have to watch it.
And I think that's why I liked it, too, is it was just more stories woven together.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you said it was like you thought that that kind of was reductive, because I think the intent was to be like, oh, there's like a little clue that only if you know Poe would you get. But I think you're probably more right than it
is.
Okay. It's a little ridiculous. But I still thought it was entertaining.
Yeah. It was a vehicle to tell their story.
Well, how do you think it stacks up in the Corman Poe cycle? Because I made a list of the different films, and this is the very first one. And they also did The Pit and the Pendulum, The Premature Burial, Tales of Terror, The Raven, Haunted Palace, Dexter Ward, Mask of the Red Death, and...
Tomb of Lygia.
Oh, yes. Have you all seen those films?
No.
Is this sort of the only one that you've seen? Maybe...
I actually just started watching Tomb of Lygia, which is the last, and it seems really good. And I have to say, it seems like a kind of repetition of The House of Usher. And I'm wondering if, whereas the Netflix series kind of takes us on a sort of linear narrative involving Poe, I'm wondering if the Poe-Corman cycle is just sort of various iterations of the same kind of story over and over.
Well, kind of made me think about...
But someone would have to watch... I mean, Premature Burial.
Yeah.
So
how do you think this stacks up with something like Psycho, considering it was what? The same year, correct?
1960, yeah.
I mean,
it's
very different,
mm-hmm.
you know, obviously, but...
One could write about how they're similar, though, too. The family curse, the importance of the house as a kind of entrapping, determining space.
Awkward relationships between family members.
Isolated location.
Trying to keep somebody in your house.
Possible incest.
Mm-hmm.
Mother, son, brother, sister.
But it's kind of interesting, then, that this one is specifically like a gothic horror film.
Yeah.
Whereas Psycho... I don't think anyone would really define as gothic. They'd say, like, you know,
I'm sure someone
first slasher. Well, yeah. That's true. There's an academic out there right now who's like, this is my moment to shine.
Psycho is gothic horror.
Yes. Well, let me just share.
I guarantee you there is someone who has written something with that title.
And if not, there will be now. But we were talking about Xavier Aldana Reyes wrote gothic horror film 1960 to present. And this appears in the Gothic World collection. And it's a really interesting article. And he distinguishes between Gothic horror and Gothic cinema. So whereas Gothic cinema may lean into things like fantasy or fairy tales, Gothic horror specifically pulls from horror conventions. So the intent is like always to frighten or to gross out the viewer. And so using that sort of broad definition, you might honestly be able to make a case for Psycho. Oh, we've just proven Psycho is the gothic.
Well, yeah, it absolutely is.
My follow-up question to that would have been, too, what's the legacy of Poe movies? Do we see them pop up in other type of things? Or is it more just nods to Poe in general?
I think it's just Poe's writing. Yeah. I don't think the film adaptations are specifically referenced as their own unique entities.
Yeah.
Like, even the Netflix series isn't really, people think of it more in terms of like Poe's writing and then just are curious to see how that's adaptive instead of it being the other way around. I mean, like, what did the film create?
Yeah, I agree.
Now, I know that we've said that Vincent Price's acting in this one didn't necessarily do us justice. However, do you think it would be better with somebody else? Because didn't he himself really just represent horror at the time? So wouldn't it have been a good choice at the time?
I mean, it was probably a bankable choice of the time. But I think, like, now I'm in my head thinking, what would this movie have looked like if it was Anthony Perkins in that role as opposed? And that changes a lot, honestly, if you have someone who's trying to do a more realistic take.
Anthony Perkins might actually be good.
Yeah, he's a good actor.
I think someone now needs to write an article on the connections between House of Usher and Psycho. And I think the adaptation of Shirley Jackson came out in 1962.
I was going to say, what else came out in 60?
The Haunting. I'm pretty sure that was 1960.
I don't know a lot about Vincent Price, like what his trajectory looked like in movies. How many more films did he make? Because I feel like in the 60s, he was still very active.
He was in Witchfinder General in 1968, yes. which was really good. And he was in, of those, I think, was that seven Poe Corman adaptations. Price was in all but one of them. And then he was in my favorite Vincent Price film, actually, is Theater of Blood.
That's a good one.
That was in the 70s sometime, I think.
But those acting choices that he makes in Witchfinder General and then the 70s movies especially, it's a different Vincent Price. I mean, this is very... And I guess it speaks to sort of the effective expectation of the 1960s. Like, you wanted those big, bold reaction shots, and you were supposed to kind of be hamming it up a little bit, too. And maybe it follows, like, as horror became taken more seriously, especially in the 1970s, when you started to see, like, the harder horror movies, it kind of makes sense, maybe, that his acting choices would change.
Yeah.
And we're going to turn to the almighty Wikipedia. It specifically states he established himself in horror genre with roles as House of Wax in 53, The Fly in 58, House on Haunted Hill in 59, Return of the Fly in 59, The Tingler in 59. So 59 was a big year for him.
The Tingler is excellent.
They don't even note this film. And then they go on to The Last Man on Earth in 64, Witchfinder General in 68, Abominable Dr. Fibes in 71, Theater of Blood 73. He collaborated with Roger Corman on The House of Usher. So that's where they mention it. Also collaborated with him with The Pit and the Pendulum, 61, Haunted Palace, 63, Mask of the Red Death, 64.
Tomb of Lygia, 64.
And then it kind of falls off after 73, it looks like, until the voice of Professor Radigan in The Great Mouse Detective.
Well, there you go. What a way to end a career. But I would be curious now to revisit then the Corman cycle of films and to see his performances, because he was clearly capable of giving restrained performances that were freaky and scary. So I wonder if it wasn't maybe Corman's direction.
Yeah. I mean, Witchfinder General is not
scary.
Yeah, and he's not campy in that film at all.
Interesting.
He reminded me of Captain Kirk. Spock.
What yeah, yes.
Do you mean? The whole film was very Kirky.
Kirky.
Well, anyway.
She's reeling us in.
I recommend this film.
I do too.
Thumbs up.
Well, the exciting news is I think we actually know what movie we're doing for the next podcast, which never happens.
It may not be the next one, though. There may be something intervening.
Okay, I lied. Never mind.
Well, we are going to do April Fool's Day.
Yes.
For April Fool's
Absolutely.
Day.
Mm-hmm. April Fool's Day.
And you know what I was going to say is, where are all the good 2024 horror movies?
They're waiting for Beetlejuice 2.
Oh, Lord.
September 6th. That is going to be like my early birthday gift.
You're going to make us do that one, aren't you?
Oh, in the theater. Okay.
I haven't watched Beetlejuice.
Ever?
No.
Ever.
Stop. Confessions.
I don't like Tim Burton that much.
Oh, I don't care for all of his films, but...
I know. You, wow.
Yep.
I think that was
Beetlejuice.
The sound of both of our jaws hitting the floor.
I think so.
I can testify that was happening.
Goodness.
I would be so fat. I wish we could put a camera on you when you watched it for the first time.
It looks so bad, though.
Oh, my God.
You're going to hate it.
We should do a group watch.
Oh, we should.
Like a virtual.
I don't
we'll start a Patreon
these,
just for that.
I don't want to keep watching these films that y'all know I won't like.
That's probably fair.
That's fair.
Okay, so we will be doing a movie, as always, and we will be back. But in the meantime, please let us know what you thought of this film or any of the other Poe adaptations that are making its way around.
Or any good horror movies that have come out in 2024 so far.
Yes, please let us know if there's anything you want us to talk about.
Absolutely.
Because left to our own devices, this is what you get.
It's going to be sharks on a plane.
Save us, please. You can find us on all things Horror Homeroom, but your best bet is probably going to be X or Facebook. And in the meantime, thank you for listening, and we will talk to you later.
Bye.